know him, you can read all about him and what he's done. I just want to say some of the things that I always hear about him around this community, which is he is the reason I'm a part of the Episcopal Church. He is a reason I am a part of St. Paul's Church. He is a reason that I can be in the Christian Church. He has opened up ways of thinking for all of us that have been life-giving and have made so many people feel welcome. So I'm really proud and honored to have him with us during the season of Lent to teach and to mentor and to open up ways of thinking about being together that I think still give life and bring together community. So, Bishop Spong, it's all yours.
Thank you. There's a certain deja vu about today, isn't there? Let me say a word first about the class. We want to start at 9 o'clock, and I want to start on the minute of 9 o'clock because we have a very limited time schedule. I'll stop the class at 9:40 for questions. I'll stop in the middle of a sentence if I have to. We'll stop the class at 9:50 so you have a chance to go to the powder room before you go to church. And we hope that that will be able to never mind. I feel I have to give you a necessary word of autobiography. I'm a stroke victim, and I worry about that in public places. The stroke occurred on September 10th, 2016, when I was in Marquette, Michigan, a lovely city on the Lake Superior in the Upper Peninsula. One doesn't quite know what a stroke is going to do, but what I know is that it causes me to cry a lot. That's a very strange feeling, to cry a lot. But if I start crying, just join me. It's not anything. I'm not sad. I'm not upset. It's just that I don't know what to do with these emotions. Second thing is I fall a lot. I've fallen 16 times since I had the stroke. I did one in church just so you'd get used to it. And I'm not steady. And third is my brain is a bit scrambled. No, I don't think I've lost any intellectual capacity. But when I'm talking, there comes a time when I cannot pull a word out to save my life. So I hope you'll be patient and be humbled by that autobiography. The title of this course, this 6 weeks Lenten course, is Creeds and Scripture in the Medium of Time. How do time and sacred words of either the creeds or the Bible relate to each other? Can any written source ever capture the eternal truth of God? How does the Bible reflect time and place in history? How does the Bible reflect the learning of its day, which is no longer the learning of our day? So I begin this session by looking at time. 13.8 billion years ago, in something we euphemistically call the Big Bang, this universe was born. It was a vast universe, bigger than any of us can imagine, and we didn't even know about it until relatively late in our history. From 13.8 billion years to 2020 is the span of time that we've got to talk about. That's going to take a little bit of time. Time is subjective. It's not objective. Time and space are qualities of creation, and I'm using a biblical word there, but they're qualities of the universe. Outside the universe, there is no time, there is no space. Time and space play off each other. The Big Bang started 13.8 billion years ago, but it's still going. The universe is still exploding, expanding. When it began, it was a materialistic, lifeless universe, made up mostly of gases. helium and hydrogen being the major ones, and billions of years passed. About 4.5 billion years ago, the solar system with its planet Earth was formed. It was still lifeless. And 3.8 billion years ago, life appeared for the first time. The form that life took was single cells called stromatolites. And the chief function of these single cells was to be able to reproduce themselves. That's what made in life. And to create oxygen. Oxygen is a product of living things. That's all they did, just pumped a little bit of oxygen into the atmosphere. And again, millions of years passed. Then those single cells began to do an unusual thing. They began to cluster. Cell specialization began. Every cell did not have to do all the functions of life. And millions of years passed. On the north side of 500 million years ago, this life that was created began to split. It was animal life and plant life. At the very beginning, they were barely separate. They hardly recognized. Look at some of the sponges. It's hard to know whether they're animal or plant. But that was a great adventure for this year. And in 500 million years ago, the Cambrian pure evolution began. And the oceans were filled with life, both plant and animal. Then some 300 million years ago, plants and animals began to abandon the sea and climb out on the land. And the land was able to receive them. It had not been up until this time. They climbed out, the animals climbed out in primitive egg-laying amphibious forms. 65 million years ago, there was something that happened that we don't quite know what it was. Probably it was the hitting of this planet Earth by a giant meteor about the size of Mars. But whatever it was, it scrambled the life forms. And the dinosaurs, the head of the food chain in the world at that time, disappeared, and all life was scrambled. And the way was open for mammalian life to begin its pilgrimage into dominance. And our first mammalian ancestor was a rat-like little creature from the grasslands of East Africa. And we've all come from that. From 6 million years ago to about 100,000 years ago, depending on how you define humanity began. There are human figures as early as 6 million years ago, but it's hard to know whether we can call that human. 100,000 years ago, language began. The human body had been evolved to a place where the vocal cords were developed and communication was improved. Then just 15,000 years ago, about, human writing began. And then about 1,850 years ago, the first glimpse of biblical history crossed the timeline. Abraham lived. The first character in the Bible to be believed to be having an existential life. 1,250 years ago, the historic Moses lived. But 940 years ago, 940 BCE, the first part of the Bible was written. Now think about that. Put those two things together. Abraham existed 900 years before the written Bible began. For 900 years, Abraham filtered through oral transmission. How much history is left to Abraham for us to read about today is very problematic. And Moses Moses lived 1,250 years ago, or some 300 years before the first word of the Bible was written. Everything we know about Moses had to filter through some 300 years of oral transmission. Think about how many generations that would take. The first part of the Bible to be written was called the Yahwist document. It dated about 940 BCE. It was called the Yahwist document because it referred to God by the name of Yahweh. It was the first written part of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It was written in the service of Jerusalem, the house of David, the temple, and the southern kingdom of Israel. It said that God chose them. They were the superior people. But there was a rebellion against the Jerusalem country. It took place about 920, and 10 northern tribes split away and formed a new nation. They had made a new capital. It was at Samaria. It was in Galilee. And there were now two Jewish nations. And the new Jewish nation could not use a script, a text for the Bible that blessed the enemy, the southern kingdom, that said the southern kingdom was where God was reigning. The second strand of the Bible was written in the northern kingdom. It's called the Elohist document because it referred to God as El or Elohim. It was also destined to be part of the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And it reflected the revolution of that northern kingdom. It was quite subjective. In the 8th century, before the Common Era, the beginning of the prophetic movement occurred. Isaiah, Micah, Amos, and Hosea, among many others. Their words were written on scrolls. Have you ever noticed that the scroll or the size of the book of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel are all about the same size? Do you wonder why? That was the size of the scroll. And when the book didn't take up the whole scroll, they would put another book right behind it and another until they'd filled the whole scroll. The fourth book of the prophets was what we call the minor prophets, the 12 minor prophets from Hosea to Malachi. And all of them were written on one book. But in Isaiah, there were three books on the scroll, and they're vastly different. First Isaiah is Isaiah 1 through 39. It was written in the 8th century. Second Isaiah is 40 through 55. It was written in the 6th century. It's the best known because that's the one that was put to music in the oratorio of the Messiah. And third Isaiah was written in the 5th century, and all three are in one book. And for most of the life of the Christians, most of the life of the use of the Bible, all those Isaiahs were considered the same person, but they're not. And Zechariah is another one. Zechariah is a strange book. Not very well known. Most people know it by the one verse in chapter 9 that says that Jesus is going to come lowly and riding upon a donkey. And that's in our Bibles when the Palm Sunday service comes along. But Zechariah 1 through 8 was written some 100 years before Zechariah 9 through 14. And there's actually a third Zechariah. But you and I don't recognize that. We call it the book of Malachi. We think Malachi is the name of a prophet. No, it's a nameless book. Malachi is a translated word that means my messenger. And it's really third Zechariah. So these books have much more depth to them, much more complexity than most of us ever imagine. You can't say it begins a third chapter of the prophet Malachi. There is no such prophet named Malachi. We may learn that someday. In 721 BCE, the northern kingdom fell to the kingdom of Assyria, and their people were carried off into exile, and they never returned. They're known as the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Where did they go? They went into the DNA of the Middle East. There's very little truth to the story that they really turned out to be the Mormons who settled in Utah. Though you will hear that from time to time. But when the northern kingdom fell, some person, we know not who, took a copy of the scriptures of the northern kingdom, the Elohist version, and brought them to the south and merged them with the Jewish version called the Yahwist version. And the beginning of the writing of the Bible began to take place. Then in the 7th century, the third narrative part of the Bible and the third part of the Torah began to be written. It was called the Deuteronomic version. It consisted of the books of Deuteronomy, which means the second giving of the law, plus 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, and some of the history of the period of Israel. And the Deuteronomic editor took the J and E version, the Yahwist Elohist version, and attached it to the Deuteronomic version and edited all of them to be a single piece of scripture. We were on the way. Somewhere between the 5th and 4th centuries, the last of the documents that made up the Torah was completed. We call them the priestly document because it's mostly about rules and regulations that govern activities like worship. The book of Leviticus is totally from the priestly writer. And you don't want a lesson very long from the book of Leviticus. You're not interested in knowing how you sacrifice a cow. The priestly document edited J, E, and D, Yahwist, Elohist, Deuteronomic, into J, E, D, and P, priestly, completing the Torah. This means that the Torah was written over a period of time of about 500 years. It is clearly not the work of a single person. We call it the books of Moses. But Moses was dead before the first word of the Torah was written. Moses did not live for 300 years after the Torah was written. So to claim the Mosaic authorship of these books is incredible. But so many people in the church still do that because they simply do not know. The book of Deuteronomy even gives us the death of Moses. It's a rare author that can write a book about his own death. It's in the 34th chapter, and you ought to go home and read it because it's a good story. God and Moses are alone on the mountain. And Moses dies, and God buries him. And then God wants to say something nice about him. He wants to have a little eulogy. And so the text says, quote, Moses was 120 years old when he died, and his eyes were not dimmed, and his natural force was not abated. That's what it says in biblical language. What it says in the language of the street is that Moses was 120 years old and needed neither eyeglasses nor Viagra. And that expressed a Jewish point of view toward life. In the year 165 before the Common Era, the last book of the Torah, or the last book of the Old Testament was written. It's the book of Daniel. The Bible is a complex book. We need to look at it in a complex fashion. Simplistic understandings of the Bible, to say the Bible is the Word of God, simply doesn't cut it. Doesn't cut it. What I want to do is to go on to the New Testament for a moment. We start in the New Testament with Jesus being born. We know now the dates that when his birth took place, pretty close. It was in 4 BC, BCE. We know that because the Bible is clear that he was born when Herod was the king, Herod the Great, and we know that Herod the Great died in 4 BC. So Jesus has to be born before 4 BC. We get to the other end of his life, and we find that Pontius Pilate was procurator of Judea for a period of time between 26 and 36. So the crucifixion occurred under Pontius Pilate, so the death of Jesus has to be between 26 and 36. Then there's some ways that we can squeeze that a little bit, squeeze it down to 28 to 32, because it seems to have happened in the earlier part of Pilate's life. And then just to make it simple, I cut in between those and make 30 the date of his death. 4 BC to 30 AD, and I'm confident we're not wrong by more than 2 years in any direction. That's where we have to start the New Testament. But not a word was written about Jesus that we still preserve until 51, when Paul began to write. 51. The first 21 years of Jesus' life, not a single word exists in any document anywhere telling us anything about Jesus. 21 years is a whole generation. The first person to write New Testament, and they didn't know they were writing New Testament, was Paul. And Paul, in his work, wrote between 51 and 64. 21 to 34 years after the life of Jesus. What do we learn from the life of Jesus, from Paul? Not very much. He refers to 4 things, but gives us no details. The 4 things are the Last Supper, that he was handed over, that he was crucified, that he was buried, and then he rose from the dead. And Paul has some interesting things about all of those, but not much. One thing that's interesting is that Paul never says that Jesus rose. He said Jesus was raised. By whom, we ask? The answer is clearly God. Jesus was raised from the dead. It's a passive tense. Jesus does not rise from the dead until you get to Luke. What does that mean? There is in Paul no birth story. They don't come into the text until very late, about 85. There is in Paul no appearance story of the resurrection. That develops very much later. There's simply an experience of Jesus alive, and Jesus says, or Paul says about this, that he rose from the dead in accordance with the scriptures. What does that mean? There was no Christian scripture. They're talking about the Jewish scriptures. What does it mean to rise from the dead according to the Jewish scriptures? Does anybody rise from the dead in the Hebrew Bible? Well, there are some people that live lives that are so virtuous that they don't die, they go translated from earth to heaven without a death. Maybe that's what they're talking about. Maybe that's what we ought to look at. So we have Paul that writes, and he writes from 51 to 40 to 64. That's the first part of the New Testament to achieve written form. And we learn almost nothing about Jesus' life in it. Now, to complicate that just a little bit, there are 14 epistles in the Bible that attribute themselves to Paul. He only wrote 7 of them. He wrote 1 Thessalonians about 51. He wrote Galatians about 52. He wrote 1 and 2 Corinthians somewhere between 54 and 56. But they were probably four epistles that have gotten collapsed into two. We have some parts of 1st and 2nd Corinthians that don't fit, and they refer to letters that we don't have. He wrote the epistle to the Romans about 56, 58. It's the most complete picture of Paul's thinking in the Bible. And he wrote Philemon about 60. It's a single little chapter about a slave named Onesimus. And he wrote Philippians about 62. And that's all Paul wrote. Some 10 years after Paul died, some of Paul's disciples wrote some other epistles and claimed Pauline authorship. What were they? They were 2 Corinthians, Colossians, and Ephesians, written about 10 years after Paul's death. Paul did not write them. You cannot say, here begins the fifth chapter of Paul's epistle to the Ephesians. It's not so. And then there are three other epistles that are written even later, a generation after Paul's life, and they're called 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. And Paul didn't write them. Paul had been dead a generation by that time. How do we know? We study those epistles for their internal evidence. The internal evidence of those epistles reveals that Paul is now a great teacher of the church with great respect. He wasn't that while he was alive. He was the most controversial man who'd been around. But if you live long enough and outlive your enemies, you get to be blessed. I'm still waiting for that. But I got a good lead on it. Paul is an elder of the church with great respect, not controversial at all. That didn't happen until he was well past that. It wasn't until 72, 42 years after the crucifixion, that the first gospel was written. That's two generations. How literal can you be about something that happened two generations ago? What do we remember from two generations ago? How literal you want to be about that? But not just that, but Mark, the first gospel written about 72, didn't have much of the things that we think of as traditional Christianity in them. Mark had no birth story. Jesus begins his life as a man coming to be baptized, an adult man coming to be baptized, and at his baptism, the Spirit of God comes upon him. That's how he was proclaimed. That's how he was understood. There's no birth story. Did Mark know there was a miraculous birth? Probably not. That's a tradition that probably developed after Paul died. Paul does say, when you look around for some hints about what he thinks about the birth, he does say that Jesus was born of a woman. I submit that's not very controversial. And the word used for woman in Greek is the same word from which we get gynecology. It didn't mean virgin. It just says he's born of a woman and he's born under the law. One other place in Paul where he does give some hint that he didn't know anything about the virgin birth is in Romans when he talks about being a descendant of the house of David. He's descended from David, but the descent is always through the male line. There's no virgin birth in Paul. Paul never heard of that. And when you get to Mark, Mark has no virgin birth. Begins with an adult Jesus being baptized. But there's some other things in the book of Mark that would indicate that Mark had never heard of the virgin birth either. Mark has Mary, the mother of Jesus, who is not named at this point. She's just called the mother of Jesus. Go with Jesus' brothers, and there were four of them, and they were named. They were Simon, Joseph, Judas, and wonder what the fourth one was. Well, there are four of them. They're named. And they go to take Jesus away because he's embarrassing them. He is, says the Gospel of Mark, beside himself. That means he's out of his mind. He's schizophrenic. A woman does not do that in an adult life for somebody that at the time she's expecting tells her she's going to be the bearer of the Messiah. She's going to be the bearer of the Son of God. Mark has no birth story at all. Mark has no resurrection appearance. No, you go home today, get your Bibles out, dust them off, turn to Mark, and you find that the 16th chapter of Mark, the last chapter, has 21 verses, if you're reading King James Bible. But if you get a modern Bible and look at it, you find that Mark ends at chapter 16, verse 8. The women flee in fear and say nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Verses 9 through 21 are a late addition to Mark's gospel. Mark's gospel circulated without verses 9 through 21 long before they appeared in the manuscripts. These extra verses talk about resurrection appearances, but they're dated about 100. Mark has no resurrection story in it. Mark is the first time that miracles are attributed to Jesus. There's no miracles in Paul. Mark is the first time that Judas Iscariot is introduced into the Christian story. Mark says he was betrayed. That doesn't really mean betrayed, but that's the word that's translated. He was handed over is the translation that is the better one. He was handed over, but Mark never says by whom. And in the resurrection, when he appeared first to Peter and then to the 12. Judas is still among them. Mark never knows that there's a tradition that one of the 12 is a traitor. That's unknown. So Mark tells his story in a very different way. But 10 years after Mark wrote, Matthew wrote. And Matthew adds some things to the story that haven't been there before. The virgin birth is an important one. A great big story about the virgin birth is in Mark. Matthew. Matthew also adds the Sermon on the Mount. It only appears one time in the Gospels, and that's in Matthew. Now, Luke has some of the same material that's in Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount, but he puts them into the plain, on the plain, and they're all scattered. And it's quite truncated. It's not a Sermon on the Mount. Matthew created the Sermon on the Mount, and Luke scattered it all the way around, that teaching all the way around his gospel. When I was in Jerusalem some years ago, and the guide showed me the exact mountain where Jesus stood when he preached the Sermon on the Mount, and I was a precocious young man, and I said, well, show me the plain where Jesus, well, Luke says Jesus delivered the same sermon, or at least some parts of it. And that tour guide looked at me as if I'd lost my mind. There's no place, no sermon on the plain. Well, there is if you know the Bible. And it's not the Sermon on the Mount. It has no Beatitudes. Well, the Beatitudes are mixed in with curses. It's an interesting story. Matthew adds some parables, like the parable of the judgment we've never heard before. Then you get to Luke, another 10 years later, maybe. And there's more doubt about dating Luke than any other book of the New Testament. Some biblical scholars that I have great respect for, like Burton Mack and Marcus Borg, date Luke about 140. I don't agree with that, but they're competent scholars, and I at least want you to know that there are people that think that. But Luke's about a decade after Matthew, and Luke has a birth story, but it's very different from Matthew's birth story. They're not compatible. I'll go into that next week. We can look at that in a little bit more detail. Luke adds some parables that nobody's ever heard of before. They just happen to be the most famous parables of the Bible. The Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, these appear only in Luke. And they appear about 90, 95 when Luke is writing his book. And the resurrection in Luke takes the resurrection and makes it very physical. The resurrected Christ walks and talks and eats and drinks. That's very physical. He offers his body to be touched and felt. That's very physical. But he also adds some other strange things. He has the body of Jesus be able to appear and disappear in an instant. That's not very physical. Doesn't sound right. That's at Emmaus. He walks, two people walk along, suddenly a third person joins them out of nowhere. And then after the supper is finished, he vanishes out of their sight. In Luke, the resurrection lasts for 40 days. Our church year is patterned on Luke. But in Luke, Jesus ascends before he appears. In John, Jesus ascends before he appears. And it's not a simple story. It's full of contradictions. Then you get John. John's written about 100. And it's different from all the others. John adds miracle stories that nobody's ever heard of before, like the raising of Lazarus. It's a great story. But can you believe that an event like the raising of Lazarus, a very public event, that nobody wrote about it for 70 years until John put it in his gospel? Isn't that a bit incredulous? John also adds the I am sayings. They're the only place in the Bible that you have the I am sayings. I am the bread of life. I am the living water. I am the good shepherd. I am the way, the truth. I am the resurrection and the life. All the I am sayings are in John. They don't appear anywhere else. They're in John. And it becomes a very interesting thing to try to understand them. Did Jesus say the I am sayings? Well, not if you read Mark. Mark says Jesus constantly said, Don't tell anybody I've done this. He didn't go out and say, I am the resurrection and the life. It just wouldn't make sense. Well, those are some of the differences. Let me quickly cut to a couple of more things that I want to talk about before next week. I want to go back to the creeds. Christian church didn't have any creeds for the first 200 years. What we call the Apostles' Creed developed in the latter years of the 3rd century. It developed as a baptismal formula. And they called it the Apostles' Creed, as if the apostles had believed this. Most of the things that are in the Apostles' Creed didn't come into existence until the apostles had already died. There was no virgin birth written before 90. 85 to 90. That's a major part of the Apostles' Creed. It was not the apostles. They don't even know who the 12 apostles were. We think we do, but we have all sorts of different lists all over the place. It doesn't make much sense to treat the Bible literally. If you can't treat it literally, can you treat it at all? If you don't accept it literally, can you accept a part of it? Let me tell you one story. I was in Burbank, California, on a book tour. It was from a book, Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism. I was being interviewed by a late-night talk host named Tom Snyder. Some of you might remember Tom Snyder. Tom Snyder was a Roman Catholic, but not a very good one. He'd been through a couple of marriages, and the church had not been very supportive to him. So we were talking about when the books of the Bible were written. And I was given a standard approach of biblical scholars. Mark about 72, Matthew about 85, Luke about 90, 95, John after 100. And Tom stopped and said, Bishop, I just got out my little short pencil. And I figured if they were written that late, they couldn't be written by the apostles. I said, that's right, Tom. They don't claim to be written by the apostles. He said, well, that's not what the nuns taught me. I said, what did the nuns teach you, Tom? He said, the nuns taught me that the disciples followed Jesus around and wrote down everything he said, and that's where we get the Bible. And I looked at him and said, Tom, did the nuns tell you that Jesus, that the disciples used ballpoint pens and spiral notebooks? And his face, it just opened up. I never thought of that. They didn't have any equipment to write on in the first century. It was hard enough to do it. But the disciples, no reason must to believe that they knew how to write at all. They didn't write the Bible that way. The Bible was not written that way. The Bible did not fall out of heaven fully developed. Can we make a case for it? Let me pose one quick question, and then we'll stop for your questions. From the creeds being written until about the 16th century, we had no serious problem with education because the vast number of people didn't read or write. Only the clergy could read and write. So we didn't bother to think about the Bible critically. But then we began to have people marching toward a new world. In the 16th century, there was a man named Copernicus. And Copernicus changed the way we look at the universe. There's no three-tiered universe. Heaven is not above the sky. And Copernicus made that clear. And Galileo helped. You could not take the Bible's view of creation and think of it as real any longer. And what does that do to the story? Every verse of the Bible is written about a three-tier universe. Otherwise, how could God hang a star in the sky to announce the birth of Jesus? It was in a three-tier universe that he could do that. How could that star go guiding across the sky, leading the wise men to where they were supposed to be? That'd be simple if it's a three-tier universe and the floor of heaven is where God lives. And you drag a star across that sky so slowly that those guys, even on camels, can follow him. How can you talk about the ascension? If Jesus wants to ascend into heaven, rising up in the sky is not going to get him there. At best, he's going to get into orbit. And at worst, he's going to sink into the infinity of space. So how can you talk about the Bible in the same way as if it's eternally true when the whole frame of reference in which the Bible is understood no longer exists? And then there was Isaac Newton, late 17th century figure. And Isaac Newton had no place in his world for what he called an invasion of a miraculous element. Isaac Newton said there were two words of God. One was the Bible, and that's the church's business. And the other is the world of nature, and that's my business. And he kept himself separate from being burned at the stake by doing that. But there's no way you can read the miracle stories of the Bible in the same way that the disciples read them when they wrote the books. It just won't work. And then there was Charles Darwin in the 19th century. Charles Darwin destroyed the basic Christian myth. What was it? Well, the basic Christian myth was that we were created perfect, and then because of original sin, we all fell into sin and needed to be rescued. I think you got to rethink that. We're born with an infinite potential, but no fall because we weren't born good. We were born incomplete. Now, we live in a world dominated by the thoughts of Copernicus and Galileo and Isaac Newton and Sigmund Freud and Charles Darwin. How can we make the Bible make sense to people if we don't look at it in a brand new way? Well, that gets us through the first day, and we'll try to press on from there next week.